This week, the precious metals continued the impressive rebound with silver stealing the show, adding more than 6%. Plus, the major equities indexes closed at yet all-time record highs. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio. Your host here, Chris Waltzek, back with big interviews and, of course, the top stories and headlines moving the market. Well, that was quite a week, wasn't it? Everybody seemed to make profits this week. The precious metals and equities and general stocks blasted higher on the heels of dovish comments following the FOMC meeting on Wednesday. My first guest is head of the 35-year-old gold brokerage McIlvaney Wealth. David McIlvaney is concerned that the global economy is, well, facing collapse, which could usher in a period of inflation unlike anything the Western world has seen in perhaps a century. He asks why our officials are so concerned about deflation. Lower prices helps make houses and related investments more affordable, giving the masses funds left over at the end of each month to invest instead of requiring credit cards for purchases. He outlines a realistic portfolio plan for everyone to maximize wealth with minimal risk. By accepting the uncertainty of future economic events, investors can position their funds for profit maximization. David advocates ignoring forecasts and instead dollar-cost averaging each month into gold. Plus, professional real estate manager Fabian Calvo expects the ECHO housing boom to persist as long as easy credit is extended to virtually everyone. Nevertheless, the entire edifice and Ponzi scheme will eventually implode amid the enormous pool of upside-down home debtors. Nearly 10 million folks are still holding on to mortgages in excess of the value of their homes. Once the last mortgage is signed, he expects the institutions that purchased these inventories to drop thousands, even millions, back on the market. So when will it be time to buy? Well, one basic rule of thumb is just multiplying the average monthly rental cost in your area, perhaps using Craigslist as an example. Let's say it's $1,000 for a similar home, and then multiplying that times 100. So you wouldn't want to pay too much more than $100,000 for that home. And I think you'd find in many communities, the number is way over that point. And don't forget, Robert Ian wraps up the broadcast today with his latest must-hear report. And I hope you'll indulge me here in a small public service announcement regarding animal rights. You know, I think folks know by now that I'm a big animal lover. I'd like to suggest that everyone consider purchasing synthetic goods instead of leather shoes and leather wallets and leather belts and things of that nature. You know, when you do so, when we turn our back on meats as well as leather, you save an animal's life. And it's just not necessary today with so many alternatives to leather, as well as meats. And not to mention, it is a super health plus, at least according to Dr. Mark Hyman, one of my favorite gurus in this area. So this is just a little suggestion here, but it's what we're trying to do here in our household. And GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weather Report. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals exchanges this week on increased tensions in Iraq and dovish comments from the U.S. Fed chair. Gold surged the most in 9 months and silver leaped to a 13-week high at Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange. Investors turned to the yellow metal, which added nearly $40, finishing at $1,314, climbing well over that key $1,300 level. The yellow metal is higher for the year by almost 10%. Silver gained the most, though, on a percentage basis, adding $1.20, over 6% in 1 week alone, just shy of $21. Palladium picked up $8, closing at $8.22. Platinum finished at $14.56, up about $21. Plus, West Texas Intermediate crude finished near break-even, around $107 per barrel. The top story driving the precious metals markets this week, dovish comments from the Federal Reserve following the Wednesday FOMC meeting. Fed Chair Dr. Janet Yellen noted that the central bank will hold rates at historically low levels for the foreseeable future. The news capped the dollar rally, sending the currency to the lowest close in weeks, encouraging gold and silver bulls. Nevertheless, Dr. Yellen offered no time frame regarding future rate hikes, and underscored that the central bank utilizes no fixed algorithm in the decision-making process. Real interest rates, though, are highly negatively correlated to gold, as seen in Gibson's Law. Economist Larry Summers' seminal paper shows that negative rates virtually guarantees a gold market. And so with the Fed planning to hold rates low and the ECB entering negative territory with its benchmark rate last week, These, I think, are two very positive events, perhaps signaling the resumption of the Gold Bull Rally. Meanwhile, despite improvements in the domestic economy, Fed Chairman Yellen was unfazed by stronger-than-expected inflation data. Nevertheless, the FOMC did cut purchases of mortgage-backed security debt for the fifth consecutive time, dropping the program from about $80 billion per month to about... Another key gold price driver this week, the U.S. president announced that 300 U.S. military advisors will be deployed to Iraq to quell a new insurgency. The Special Operations Forces will work with Iraqi officials to ameliorate relations with the Sunni population. That according to a Wall Street report. The geopolitical flashpoint increased investment demand for gold and silver as safe havens against potential market instability. Another important event this week is the unwinding of China's commodity financing deals. Apparently, speculators must sell their physical gold while simultaneously closing gold hedges in the futures market. This is somewhat bullish. Plus, there are some probes in the nation being made into potential gold market manipulation, which could encourage further purchases. Bottom line on the precious metals. This was clearly a pivotal week for the market. The bears were caught simply flat-footed at key support and trampled underfoot by a stealth bull market rally. For next week's report with all the forecasts, stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange as the two top benchmark indices closed at yet new record highs, and the Nasdaq closed at the highest point since the year 2000 collapse. Investors rejoiced amid solid employment figures and dovish comments from the Fed. For the week, the Dow added 171 points, finishing at 16,947. The S&P 500 picked up 26 points, wrapping up at 1962, while the Nasdaq gained 57, closing at 4,368. A top story underlying the equities rally this week was the better-than-expected employment figure. Weekly jobless claims climbed by 6,000 to 312,000 last week, slightly better than expected. With a national unemployment rate near the Fed's target, investors view the current environment as close to Goldilocks as possible, just right for profits. However, one caveat I think is required here. The inflation figures are pointing to higher prices, which could cause the Fed to shift tack abruptly from dovish to hawkish, which might bring the amazing stock market rally to a halt later this year. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the seven-component sentiment index pendulum remains in extreme territory despite the strong market advance. Now, this is, I think, most certainly bearish from a contrarian perspective. I would caution listeners to beware of a potential turnaround here. And that's not to say that the market has topped, only that the indexes do not seem to truly be reflecting the overall underlying individual stocks, at least the ones that I follow closely. And this could be a sign of manipulation, or maybe even this week was quadruple witching, where there's considerable unwinding of derivatives and options contracts. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with our two top guests this week, David McElvaney and Fabian Calvo. We'd like for you to stay with us here at Gold Seek. David McElvaney makes his debut on GoldSeek.com radio. He has, similar, I think, views as we do here on the global banking system, the fragility there, and just how, well, the financial system could be facing collapse. He's president of McElvaney Financial Group, which is a 35-year-old precious metals brokerage company. He's been a featured speaker all around the country regarding world events. Welcome, David McElvaney. Let's begin with the fragility of empires. I think you do a great job on this topic. After all, you know, the U.S. is the largest empire in history. We don't really think of ourselves in this context, though, do we? You know, empires tend, though, to overextend and then collapse. Tell us more, please.
It's certainly something that we're not wanting to admit to the world, that we are an empire. It implies we like a different kind of power. We like influence. We like to do favors for others and then sort of leave strings attached dangling out there. You see that with the IMF. You see that with the World Bank. You see that with a lot of our foreign policy. You see that with our military bases strewn here and there. We promise security, and they deliver healthy relationships in terms of business and finance, and so there is some quid pro quo. So you're right. We are an empire, but we don't like to admit it. And you're right, just like most empires, there is a little bit of overreach at some point, and very few politicians are willing to deal with the economic issues of their day, basically take responsibility for making bad decisions. And so you usually see that show up in a currency. The currency is where you begin to see an indication of decline and really not owning decisions that have been made in terms of public policy. So the high cost ends up coming to the middle class. The high cost ends up coming to the man on the street. Doesn't necessarily know why things cost more from one year to the next, but you can, in fact, trace it back to mismanaging fiscal policies and overcommitting in terms of social programs and spending initiatives. And so we see that we are nearing the end of a long-run cycle. Does that mean we've got another 20 or 30 years? I don't know. Certainly we won't make the 400-year stretch that the Romans made.
I also think it's important that people find out where we went wrong. You know, when you think back to our earlier education, we were essentially taught that inflation is due to higher prices. And that essentially comes from the fact that the economy is overheating. We're doing so well that prices just have to go higher in order to compensate suppliers and manufacturers. Their cost of input and whatnot are increasing. They need to be compensated fairly. Well, we read von Mises, we read Hayek, and we learned, wait a minute, there is another school here of thought, the Austrian school. Do you subscribe to that viewpoint? And if so, tell us more.
I certainly have some influences from the Austrian school. I wouldn't say that I'm an investor driven by an ideology, but certainly it's wise to see where Hayek's contribution came in, von Mises's contribution came in, and many others before them. So I think what you look at in the 1860 to 1914 period is an example of why deflation is good. You had prices coming down, not going up. You had global growth. You certainly had cooperation internationally. The international monetary system worked more smoothly then, arguably than any other time in world history. There might be a 20-year stretch in the modern era that mimicked some degree of stability, but we were on an international gold standard at that point. And so your income always went a little bit further each year, which was kind of an interesting thing. That's quite the opposite in an inflationary-driven, Keynesian-driven monetary era, and that is, it takes more money to buy the same goods and services each year. It's not that the cost of those things are going up and they're an indication of great success. It's the fact that it takes more dollars to buy the same goods and services. So, you know, from the time the Federal Reserve was started in 1913, the dollar has lost roughly 96% of the value, that is, purchasing power that it has. So you have to earn a considerable amount more just to buy the same stuff. Frankly, I prefer the old mild deflation of the gold standard era, 1860 to 1914. What the government doesn't like about it is that any increase to your income, which you basically had by expanded purchasing power through a declining cost of goods and services, it can't be taxed. And lo and behold, 1913 stitches together an interesting piece into the tapestry. And it is that in 1913, not only did we create the Federal Reserve, the money printing machine, but we also created the graduated income tax. Now, all of a sudden, the money mandarins are in league or at least running in a parallel track with the folks in Washington, D.C. As you expand a budget, you can print more to do it, and it gives them the opportunity to increase your taxes every year as your income is increasing as a consequence of inflation as well. So, you know, expanded revenues for government, an expansion of government, the Leviathan grows. Chris, I'm a small government guy, so maybe this is my point of criticism or departure. I think we lost it around 1913 and have a lot to gain back. Don't know if we're going to do it, though.
I mean, we're certainly on board with you. Obviously, the Leviathan has just simply grown beyond its means. I mean, it's now trying to consume itself. And this is inevitable because I think the ontology that you outlined here, the worldview, is difficult for most people in this modern world to wrap their minds around because we were born into the system. I mean, we don't understand the fact that a deflationary environment is ultimately the best one for almost everyone involved, except for maybe a few elite, top 1% of 1%, maybe would prefer to see an inflationary system where the middle class is gutted. So I think your point is well made. Wanted to move on, though, to portfolio planning. Now, this is an essential tool today, I think even more so than it was in the past. You have a unique perspective on the ideal portfolio. And assuming that our audience has, let's say, $5,000 to invest, I wonder if you'd outline just what every investor needs to know here.
Well, very simple. I mean, one of the things that we start with is by saying we don't know what tomorrow holds. There are a variety of outcomes. Given the fact that we've accumulated so much debt in the system, we could very well have a deflationary collapse. We could have pressure in the bond market. We could have things that would make something like cash very important. On the other hand, we have all the machinery in place for something even beyond Weimar Germany, because we're not limited any longer by cutting down trees, turning it into paper pulp, and then actually printing digits on a piece of paper. We do it all digitally now. It's ones and zeros in the digital ether, and the ability to create debits and credits into the trillions of dollars can be done with a matter of keystrokes instantly. So, you know, where do we stand? Inflation, deflation, maybe a positive growth environment for the economy. I think we have to start with this basic assumption as an investor. We don't necessarily know how this is going to play out. And so with some degree of humility, it's worth having a variety of asset classes in play which accommodate a variety of outcomes. We like cash. We like gold. We like stocks. And there you have it. I mean, in essence, if you drew a triangle, let's say an equilateral triangle for simplicity's sake, and you had a third of your liquid assets in cash, a third of your liquid assets in precious metals, gold and silver, and a third of your assets in stocks, guess what's going to happen? Over a long period of time, you're going to find that you've got a certain number of horses pulling for you in one category more than another. Throughout the 80s and 90s, gold didn't do much. The major engine of growth in your portfolio would have been stocks. Now, Wall Street would say, if that's where you're supposed to be all in. Put 100% of your money there. The problem is you don't know what tomorrow brings, going back to our original starting point. So having a diversified portfolio to us does not mean having, you know, a mix of small, large, and mid-cap stocks, some of them value, some of them growth, with a little bit of a venture into fixed income, depending on age. That's kind of how Wall Street tends to think in those two major asset classes, fixed income and equities. We'd say paper assets, left side. Okay, and they're growth-oriented, maybe income-oriented. On the right side of the triangle, it's cash. And on the bottom of the triangle, the foundation of the triangle, it's precious metals, gold and silver. So $5,000, you could split it three ways and have roughly $1,666. Split those three ways. And I think what you've prepared for is any eventuality.
On paper, maybe it seems simplistic, but you cannot, again, underestimate the power of what you've shared with us today. And I'd like to just give a couple of illustrations. You know, it's easy, I think, to try to outthink the market. However, when we do that, we forget that we're competing against a million other of the sharpest minds out there, and our odds evaporate quickly. As you mentioned, the 20-year bear market from 1980 to, let's say, around 2000, 2001 for the yellow metal, just a barbarous relic. You'd have missed out on one of the greatest rallies, 12-year unbroken rally in the yellow metal. Similarly, if you were all in on the precious metals from the year 2000, you might have missed out on the 2009 rally into 2014 in stocks. Given that every fiat currency has eventually been destroyed by inflation, I wonder if you could tell listeners today your position on higher prices.
Inflation is the consequence. What we see in terms of price inflation is a consequence of monetary policy run amok. And you, when you overextend in the debt markets and finally can't finance your way out of a mess, then you generally see a major pickup in inflation. Will we in the future see a minor version of that? A major version of that, which would take us to superinflation and sort of double-digit monthly rates, or even hyperinflation, triple-digit monthly rates. We could see any of the above. It's a bit of a confidence game. We still have dollar reserve currency status, though that's being eroded, we do still haven't. As and when we don't have that, I think our desperate position becomes more obvious and will compound on itself very quickly. Inflation is one of those things that most people consider strictly monetary issue. And what they forget is that you and I are actors in the marketplace, and we're surrounded by millions and billions of other sometimes rational actors and sometimes not rational actors. But we do choose to invest our money a certain way, to spend our money a certain way, and inflation has this deeply psychological and sociological element to it. So when you see an inflation expectation change, it really is not because a number has changed. It's because something in the mass mind has changed. And that's really difficult to call. When and how that changes, it's a matter of perception. It's a matter of connivance and conning by the powers that be that are running the printing presses. And when do they lose control in terms of, again, controlling expectations and the confidence of the mass of people out there? Controlling expectations. We look at a number of things, and I'm sure you do as well. The modeling for inflation is very different now than it was in the 1980s. Very few people would call Paul Volcker, and yet we don't use his metrics for inflation. Today's sub 2% would be over 8%, according to his model. Just looking at today's numbers and the things that they factor in to determine the current inflation rate. So what is it? Is it 2% or is it north of 8%? Well, according to the new model, there is no inflation. Meanwhile, we have families across this great country of ours who are frustrated not being able to make ends meet. They run out of money before they run out of end of month. And that's an impossibility for them. What do? Well, most of them put it on the credit card. The small difference that they have to make ends meet, they just put it on the credit card and hope things are brighter tomorrow. Inflation is ultimately, I think, our major issue. Deflation, I know many people are very, very concerned about this. I am as well. But you've got the world central bankers who all studied at the same universities, all read the same books, and they understand the machinery that's necessary to avoid what everyone fears in the central banking community, a period of time like the 1929 to 1937 period. They want to avoid it, and they'll do everything they can. 2002 speech from Ben Bernanke made that very clear. They will go as far as dropping money from helicopters. That is to say, they will put money in people's pockets and force them to spend it to keep the economy going and keep things rolling. Most of the machinery that they have is inherently inflationary.
I think our officials understand history. They maybe studied just a little bit more of it than we're aware. And they recognize that when the middle class, when the working classes, they see their budgets pinched. They're having difficult times. There really isn't any revolt. There won't be anyone in the streets. There won't be too much backlash or blowback until they can't put food on the table. And what I think our officials, the as you call them, the powers that be, realize here, if we throw out about 50 million food stamp cards and we keep them, well, filled up each month, they'll continue paying their credit card debt, their student loan debt, their mortgage debt, their automobile, you know, loans. This will just keep rolling along, and eventually the ship will right itself, the economic Titanic, and everything will be fine. We'll be back to the 1980s and the 1990s. Maybe it's not going to be that easy this time. Tell us more.
Political continuity requires freebies, and this wasn't always the case. We did not see the budget fully politicized until after World War II. So there's good things that come with universal suffrage and democratic expression. We see that. We like that. That's wonderful. But one of the things that you do when you expand the vote is you politicize the budget. Now politicians are very concerned what people think, what people feel, how people are going to vote in a midterm or every 4 years. And so the budget becomes the means by which you buy votes. Political continuity, again, requires freebies. So from pork barrel spending going to major corporations and government contracts to the 47-plus million food stamp recipients that you mentioned, you know, this is where we are today. The only way that they can ensure a political legacy and be written into the history books as a success, as a politician, is to make sure that the freebies keep flowing.
Unfortunately, the way the system is set up, the way the machinery is in place, you know, the only way to keep it greased and keep the cogs spinning is to offer more goodies to the masses. Otherwise, the day of reckoning is here. and we have to pay the bill. And it is an enormous bill, over $17 trillion. Now the national debt is, I believe, in excess of our annual GDP. If we take everything that's produced by our businesses, by John Q. Public, we owe more than we make in a year. This is problematic, to say the least. Of course, we haven't even added in the other liabilities there, such as Medicaid, Medicare, and so many other of the systems and programs in place. Some estimates show anywhere from $60 trillion to $200+ trillion in liabilities. So at some point, they're going to have to rev up that printing press you're talking about, chop down all the trees in the forest, in the national forest, or we have to get our house in order. What's going to happen?
An interesting period of time because we have some transitions immediately ahead of us. We prioritize democracy over the other forms of government. That's what we've tried to export to places like the Middle East. We have certainly things that they can't put in place in a heartbeat. We have a history of the rule of law, and democracy is more functional here. Freedom, as a better expression, not just democracy, but freedom, is functional in the context of the rule of law. And yet democracy is something that ultimately erodes the freedoms that we have because, again, it's just a question of the mass number of people figuring out that they can vote for themselves largesse from the tax take. And it just ends up being a redistribution of wealth. That's essentially when democracy is in its sort of final death throes, it's because people have figured that they can vote from the public treasury, vote for themselves in interest from the public treasury.
Most Americans claim to have less than $2,000 in cash. Now, this is a disturbing figure, to say the least, but in this environment. But what about if things get worse, as many pundits are pointing to? What type of hardships will this group of Americans, keep in mind that's over 150 million of us, what will we be facing?
I think you're talking about social chaos. There's no question in my mind, if there wasn't 47,000 food stamp recipients, there'd be 47 million rioters. I mean, we don't live in the cordial, respectful times of the sort of post-Victorian era. We live in a very brutal environment where I don't think people care about anything but themselves. And if I can't feed myself, I'm going to take what I need for myself. And where is the decorum, the general generosity that you could have expected 100 years ago today? I'm sorry. I mean, maybe this is a little bit overdone for me, but I just don't get the sense that my neighbor would do anything other than eat me. If it came to him being hungry and me being the food.
I would say this about the cannibals knocking at your door at the McIlvaney residence. I would give them this food for thought, okay, pun intended. But we do have to remember that as students of history, this has happened many times before. People, they've just watched their wealth and livelihood eroded before their eyes, and there was really very little they could do. You know, we were just talking about the 150 million Americans who don't even have $2,000. How can they really invest in precious metals to protect against an upcoming hyperinflation? At this point, it may be too late. I would just simply make the argument, yes, jump up and down, let's get everyone off the railroad tracks, but then we're going to have to find ways to work with the 150 million people who really had very little preparation there. Finally, here are your thoughts on precious metals. After the 12-year unbroken run that we've alluded to earlier, you know, the advance halted abruptly in 2011, and it appears, though, that the worst might be behind the market. I know our listeners are all ears on your thoughts on gold.
Let's say, for instance, that it's not behind us. Let's say that we could go to $1,000. Let's say we could go to $850. We're dealing with economic realities which are, in fact, mind-boggling. The fact that we have not just $1 trillion in derivatives, not just $20 trillion in derivatives, but we have hundreds of trillions, close to $250 billion in notional value of derivatives. That means there's layers upon layers upon layers of bets in the financial system. I think when you look at the world from a slightly different perspective, I don't own gold to profit. I own the gold as an insurance policy. And I think every day is a good day to be, if you're the first-time buyer, establishing an insurance policy. The last thing you really want is for your insurance policy to pay. Yeah, so that's the issue. Is you can blur what gold does in a portfolio. I think it does best as an offset to loss, an offset to volatility in the equity markets, an offset to purchasing power lost via central planners and central bankers. What I would say is we may have more downside volatility. As often as I can, as readily as I can, I'm going to continue to add to my gold position. And that means that I've done that consistently with some discipline at $300 an ounce and at $1,600 an ounce. And it doesn't matter to me that from $1,600 to $12 and change, I have a loss. That's not why I own it in the first place. As an anchor to my portfolio, I will ultimately be selling ounces and repositioning in other assets anyways. What I really care about is not the price of gold, but its purchasing power. So, for instance, when you look at the Dow and the gold and the ratio between them, today it's at 13 to 1. 1 ounce of gold will buy you basically 13 shares, if you will, of a cross-section of the Dow 30. Now, that number has been as high as 43 and as low as 6 in the last 12 years. So we've seen a retrenchment. That's right, 2 years of a retrenchment. We've gone from a 6 to 1 ratio up to 13. In price terms, nominal price terms, that represents gold going from 1,900 down to 1,200 and the stock market going from 12 to 16,000 and change. Am I interested in owning stocks today over gold? No, I don't think so, because at a 13 to 1 ratio, the stock market is still not compelling. It's lost 70% of its value in gold terms, and I think it's going to end up losing a total of about 85 or 90% of its value in gold terms. At which point, guess what? You can have my gold, and I don't care if gold is $500 an ounce or $5,000 an ounce. For me, it is a value exchange. I treat gold as money, and ultimately, when I can spend that money on good value, I'll do so. I don't care what the price is in nominal terms, because if I'm locked into the shenanigans that are played by central bankers all over the world, where do you have grounding and perspective for what this stuff is worth. In the Weimar Republic, you remember that you had 1 ounce of silver trading for hundreds of billions of marks. You were on your way to the poorhouse unless you had foreign currency and precious metals. What you're talking about is the ultimate decline, decay, and death of a currency. We don't have anything that extreme here today, but all I'm saying is that you can't think of things in nominal terms. Think of things in terms of purchasing power. How many ounces is it going to take me to buy an acre? How many ounces is it going to take me to buy a house? How many ounces is it going to take me to buy my cross-section of the Dow? Typically, you will see, in a purely economic cycle, a 3-to-1 Dow-gold ratio. I'm happy to buy gold here. I don't care what the price is. At a 13-to-1 ratio, it's compelling because I know that my purchasing power, the difference between a 13-to-1 ratio and a 3-to-1 ratio, is a major expansion in terms of my economic and financial footprint. That's a legacy, a financial legacy I want to leave for my family.
Just like a life preserver. You know, I know this is an overused, trite example, but I mean, take a look at the one guy selling life preservers on the Titanic. Up until it started to capsize, you know, he couldn't have gotten a dollar for a life preserver. Tens of millions of dollars in those last few minutes. I mean, we're facing something similar here. One of our best friends of the show here, Robert Kiyosaki, who I think agrees with you in a very down-to-earth way. He says, look, I buy gold every month. I don't care how high or how low it is, simply because I don't trust the people printing the money. I just don't trust them. I think that's so succinct, and it just captures the epistemology that we're sharing here today. David McElvaney, any other topics that I haven't covered that you'd like to leave with the listening audience?
You know, we've been in the precious metals business for 42 years. We've brokered gold and silver all over the world and are one of the largest firms to still do that today. Family-owned business. So, you know, when you mentioned me learning to talk about inflation when I was 6, it's because I started traveling with my dad when I was 3. I just got back from Normandy, bringing my boys back from the 70th anniversary of D-Day. They're 8 and 5. I want them to understand history. I want them to be able to speak to it. I want them to be able to ultimately fill my shoes as I filled my father's shoes in a way that serves our client base on a much broader and longer-term basis than one generation can do. 42 years in the business. We love to educate. Our weekly commentary is available for free on our website at McElvaney.com. Be happy to send current DVDs that, again, just educational overviews, which we think are very, very important for gaining perspective and making wise decisions in the time that we live in.
David McElvaney, we want to wish you continued success and look forward to having you back here on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Thank you, Chris.
Fabian Calvo manages millions of dollars of distressed mortgages each year at thenotehouse.us. Welcome back, Fabian Calvo.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chris. It's always great to be with you.
Let's begin with the housing recovery in quotation marks. You know, since 2010, the media is portraying a rosy scenario. It may not be as sanguine, though, as folks are saying. Housing formations are down over the past 5 years, and from the recession, the number of households established is plummeting. That's almost a million per year from the previous 7 years, if we use that as our base. 4 million additional households that we would have normally seen formed simply evaporated. So the pool of first-time buyers is dwindling here. What do you think?
Well, there's no question that because of the lending guidelines that were issued, particularly after the 08 crash, that, of course, lending came to a screeching halt, and borrowers that used to be able to get financing relatively easy were basically out of the market. You know, I still am holding, Chris, to my forecast, and I'm beginning to see the evidence of this everywhere, that this is beginning to change. And one just needs to look at recent FHA guidelines. For A, they want to reduce the risk that banks take on when they make loans, risky loans, and having the risk of having to buy back that loan in case that loan goes into foreclosure. This is one of the main indicators that actually one of the main things that led to the last real estate bubble was that, you know, banks basically got off the hook with creating these new financial instruments to subprime borrowers or even credit-worthy borrowers and being able to have access in the secondary market to sell those loans very quickly. So it was a fuel, literally fuel added to the fire. Well, that's already beginning to happen now. We know going back to 2010, 2011, the Obama administration lobbying the banks to basically reduce the lending restrictions to subprime borrowers. Wells Fargo's leading the way with this. So, you know, I often say that all stories are pretty much connected, particularly economic stories. You know, today we find out the Fed tapers another $10 billion. And I'm convinced that they're hanging their hat on a wave of cheap money loans to create the additional illusion that the economy is doing well, particularly the housing market's doing well, because pretty much every Fed chief, the last three or four Fed chiefs, have always said, look, one of the main things about the U.S. economy is the housing market. If the housing market's doing well, you know, there's this notion that people have that they're wealthy because they're sitting on equity. And I think that's where this is heading.
If we turn up the magnification of the market, I mean, we do see nearly 10 million home debtors still upside down on their mortgages. They think they're sitting on equity, but in reality, they owe more than the home is worth. Pull them out of the equation because they're stuck. They can't sell. They can't buy. They are stuck in that home. Tell me what you think about 10 million folks underwater. Is this going to right itself or will the ship capsize?
Definitely, I think the central planners are trying to fuel what they've done basically in the equity market, which we've seen that was revealed this last weekend, something you and I and this audience has known now for years, that central banks were pumping in money to basically fuel the equities market, and we find out the number is close to $30 trillion. Well, the same thing's going to happen with real estate. And so I think for those underwater, take a state like Florida, 20% to 25% of every home in Florida is in foreclosure. That's not counting the shadow inventory or what's called vampire REOs, properties that are basically just sitting on the market, vacant, and they're just sitting there. So I think that the central planners think, you know, if we continue to fuel the bubble, we'll be able to get these people out of this situation by having the manipulation in the market have the price of their home increase. And, you know, that's not only a very risky move, it's really an insane move because it's contrary to how a free market should function. But I think this is all, it's the equities manipulation I talked about, the real estate manipulation, I think many would agree all markets are manipulated. And in my studies of history, looking at other crises with economies or currencies that have gone through a crisis, this is really symbolic of an end of the road life cycle almost of an economy. It's that the central planners run amok and they basically think they can control everything by tweaking a lever here or making another, you know, moving something else over here, and we know that that's just going to fail miserably.
You know, I think you made a great point there. Folks don't think of housing as a Ponzi scheme because, as you said, well, they're sitting on equity. It really does take a pool of folks who are convinced that if I buy this place, you know, it's going to keep moving higher. This is a number I find startling. When folks are foreclosed on, and there were tens of millions of them, or let's say at least 5 to 10 million, they are expected to come back into the market and buy homes. But only 1 in 4 ever buys a home again. They rent for the rest of their lives. What is it that they've learned that maybe some of us need to learn?
Well, I think if anything, they've learned that there is really predatory financing out there. I mean, you know, I'm a big believer in personal responsibility, and I'm somebody who believes that, you know, the life you have, by and large, is created by the actions or the behaviors you have. But that doesn't mean there's not rampant fraud and criminals out there that take advantage of people. In the case of a lot of subprime loans, or even for that matter, Chris, credit-worthy borrowers that, you know, they don't really know all the fine print. They don't, but they're sold these loans by whether mortgage brokers or a lot of mortgage bankers, and it's totally just you know, it's really a bait and switch, the classic bait and switch. It's, hey, your payment will be X. It'll be less than your rent payment. You can't go wrong. And then a year later, they're looking at a double or tripling of their mortgage payment. So I think, you know, that someone's burned in a fraud like that, it pretty much, you know, burns pretty deep. And I think that's what those borrowers know. But, I mean, when we talk about the greater picture of loss of confidence, I mean, I think that really trust is pretty much the biggest thing in any financial market for it to function properly. And, you know, I every day I see more evidence that trust is going out the window. But people need to still remember that there's still a large section of the population that buys into the gimmick of, hey, you know, you can easily qualify for a loan. Look at the subprime car loans for GM. I mean, 80% plus are subprime loans. And people come in and they don't even think about, hey, maybe I own my car free and clear. I don't have a car payment, but I can now go in and get a really qualify for a loan regardless of my credit score and have more debt. They don't really think it through. And I think that's a real big problem. And ultimately, you know, as much like I said, a lot of that comes down to people's understanding of not just financial markets, but just of how to lead a life that is, you know, dealing with your financial reality.
You know, and I think financial reality and success and wherewithal all hinge upon those decisions that you alluded to. And if interest rates are low, well, it only makes sense to purchase something, right? Held near zero here by the Federal Reserve for the longest stretch, I think, on record. And nevertheless, we still see signs of cracks in the foundation of the real estate market.
Well, Chris, let me just say it is, and this is what I've talked about for years now, which is, you know, real estate, like stocks, is really we see a collusion between central planners, the media, which is owned by the big Wall Street banks, and people within government that collude to put out this notion of the American dream is owning a home, getting into debt, or that, you know, you have to have a 401k, that's the way you save for retirement. And it's full-blown propaganda. And, you know, I think a lot of people are getting past that and recognizing that they've been sold a bag of goods, but there's still, I think, a majority that buy into that. And look, we're sitting on the millennial generation that is saddled with student loan debt. Fannie Mae recently did a survey about millennials, and basically they said the main obstacle was the student loan debt to stop them from buying a new home. Well, you know, like any central planning government that is, you know, they always try to fix the problem. So for them, fixing the problem is let's give them more cheap money so then they can go out and buy a home. And the millennial generation rivals the baby boomer generation in size. And so, look, if you're able to unleash credit to, whether they qualify for it or not, to that generation to go out and buy homes, I mean, you're talking about a gigantic boom in real estate prices. Again, let me just be clear. This is full-blown manipulation, but I think this is where it's headed.
No, exactly. And I just read an article today by Charles Hughes Smith, one of my favorite pundits in the area of two minds. And he points out that those millennials that you pointed to will not be able to purchase homes at least until 2020 due to the staggering debt levels. Another hurdle towards full-blown recovery, I guess. According to the metrics, I mean, we have seen unemployment, or the national unemployment rate, plunge to around the Fed's target level. So according to the Fed, we are right on target. And as you know, they pulled the plug on even more tapering. So another 10, I believe, billion tapering per month. Everything would seem as though that things are getting better. But you know, yes, there are more jobs out there, at least on paper. But here's, I think, the crux of it that not many people are catching. And that is that there just aren't the high-paying jobs we saw in the mid-2000s, early to mid-2000s. And it's those high-paying jobs with benefits and perquisites that I think make the opportunity of buying a home seem more reasonable to most people. What do you think?
Well, you know, you touched on a lot of good points there. First, I think that history will show, I'm in the camp that the Fed on paper and in their official minutes come out and say that they're going to taper. You know, we look at what happened with Belgium just at the end of last year, where they were, you know, they bought the equivalent of, I think it was 40% of their GDP in 1 month in U.S. Treasuries. And many believe, including myself, that the Fed literally laundered money to them for they can keep buying debt. Now, we also talked about interest rates at an all-time low. How can the Fed possibly keep interest rates at an all-time low if they're not fueling the bond market by buying more bonds? Because the question begs, who's buying the bonds? I mean, we know that China hasn't been buying as many bonds, and we know there was a report not too long ago, and I think a lot of this is propaganda, saying, well, you know, there was a big surge in buyers of T-bills. You know, I'm just not believing it, and I think just like I've been on record and so many others, Chris, that all of these markets are manipulated, and then we find out more evidence. You know, the gold market's manipulated. We have banks that get caught manipulating gold. We have central banks that are caught injecting $30 trillion into global equities markets. We'll find, history will show, the Fed is one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in the history of mankind. And I think that, you know, when those cracks begin to unfold, that's when trust will be completely lost. So, you know, that's what I have to say with respect to this notion that the Fed is tapering. With respect to the overall economy, you're absolutely right. The job picture is grim by the standards of what you get paid. And I think that there's a lot of things that are happening in the world we live in today. One of them is that inflation, as we saw just consumer pricing in May, shot through the roof with, you know, basic essential food essentials. So working at a 9-to-5 consumer-based type job can barely get by. And that's only going to continue as we see this disparity between the people at the top, the entrepreneurs and the business owners, and then the people at the very top, the 1% of 1%, which are the crony capitalists, and then everybody else at the bottom. And, you know, I think that's why I often talk about, Chris, getting out of this job paradigm, because the job paradigm is collapsing. I don't believe we're going to have the jobs come back that our grandparents and that our parents enjoyed, the ones that you speak of.
If you're going to try to go that route, though, the traditional route, you're really going to have to be specific. You're going to have to look in areas that are recession-proof and technology-proof to a lesser extent. For instance, healthcare, a solid area with the baby boomers, over 60 million folks retiring from 46 to 64. That's going to be a huge theme here in the next 10, 15, 20 years. So healthcare, of course, and it requires substantial investment in training on your part, which a lot of people just aren't prepared for here. But I'd like to continue with this theme of the echo bubble, call it the housing bubble 2.0. Many folks have alluded to recently that this has been driven entirely by all cash purchases. I know this is your forte. Of course, there's also that Fed-engineered interest rate related aspect there. Why don't you tell us why this bubble could fail, how it could do so, and what that means for the typical listener?
Well, it is definitely a cash bubble that's being created. So basically, and I keep going back to this because this is really indicative of what's happening in housing. Again, we see central banks buying $30 trillion in equities. Well, you know, what happens is a lot of the banks that sit on the board of these central banks, or that own these central banks, they print a big, you know, chunk of money, a big tranche of money, and they skim off the top. So if they print a trillion, they're going to take a couple hundred billion, and they're going to go run to go buy hard assets. And in this case, many of them are buying real estate, all across the country, all across the world, but particularly in the U.S., where Wall Street has now become the biggest landlord. So without that injection of capital in the housing market, our housing market would be much more dire even than it is right now. Now, this goes to my theory, and we've talked about this before, that these people are buying because they have an end an exit strategy, and their exit strategy is to unload a lot of these properties to buyers who qualify for financing. Let me give you another thing that these people are doing, that are these big Wall Street banks. They're buying, and I'm talking, Chris, thousands, tens of thousands of properties on a monthly basis. A lot of this inventory isn't even accounted for by the National Association of Realtors, which we know, and people can just check this out themselves, is notorious for fudging the numbers and has double-counted sales in the past. But a lot of the cash sales that are done when somebody buys 2,000 homes at a time or buys 5,000 homes at a time, that's not accounted for in the National Association of Realtors statistics. So those are truly off-market type transactions. So these Wall Street banks are buying these homes. They're doing what's called, many of them are doing what's called basically a land contract or owner financing, where they tell a buyer that has poor credit, you can get in for $500 down, your monthly payment, your interest rate might be 15-16%, but we'll still make it less than the $50 less, $25 less than the average rent in the area. Well, they're bundling up these new mortgages that they're writing, and they're now selling those as securities. So this is uncharted territory for the real estate market. We know that a lot of some of the bondholders or some of the companies that rate bonds are beginning to rate these so-called land contracts or new mortgages that are being written, and I think a collapse in those could really destroy the U.S. housing market for decades to come, quite frankly. This is one of the most underreported things going on in the financial market currently, and it's really could be a potential ticking time bomb.
What I'd like to do is give people some key walkaway points, acid test, so that people can say, you know what, I've got to move into a new community, or I'm interested in purchasing a home. What can I do quickly to assess the true intrinsic value, the fundamental value, the fire sale value? And even if I know nothing about the community, just take the going rental rate, look at Craigslist, average the houses that are similar, take that monthly rate and multiply it times 100 to give a ballpark idea. And then if it has a pool or a beautiful view or a quiet neighborhood or a gated community, or, you know, we add the perquisites on top of that. This community I live in, which is a very exclusive community, you can't find a home anywhere near 100 times the rental rate. And I think that means homes are overpriced.
Definitely, you know, the rent multipliers has been used for many times. I think one of the things to be wary about it is the following. Is I think in certain well-established metro markets, that could potentially work and be an indicator that prices could be overvalued. However, in some markets where you have landlords that are doing whatever they can to try to fill up the units, you know, they might advertise the rent 15-20% higher, and then what they do is they basically give concessions in rent. So you get 3 months off, 2 months off, but you're going to pay this higher rent when you come in. So that distorts the market significantly. For me, I think here's a few things that I would say. If you're looking to buy a new home and you're going to take on debt to buy that new home, and you're going to be able to qualify for a 3% loan, 3.5% loan, and you're going to live in that home long term, I would take that deal because, quite frankly, I don't think we'll ever see rates that low again in history when the big crash does come and when you know the Ponzi scheme is exposed. So that would be one of the first things I'd say. The other thing too is that if you have the access capital to buy a property cash, and I personally look at it as a hard asset that you can diversify from, but people need to understand they need to get away from different types of auctions or different types of bidding wars. If there's, you know, for me, one of my rules for buying any property is I will never, ever bid against somebody else. I'll never do it because I don't want to get caught up in the euphoria of, you know, trying to basically compete with other people. I mean, Chris, one of the largest auction sites, auction.com online, has in my opinion, in my firm's deep research and what we believe, has built in algorithms where they themselves bid on behalf of the sellers they represent to do just what we've talked about, to build that euphoria. So, again, there's all these different types of deceptions that are used in the marketplace to distort the market. So, you know, again, and the last thing I would say with respect to regarding the real estate market, and just something to really consider. And, you know, having a place to live that you can call home, I think, has some value to it. To best find that value, make sure that you're not overpaying for the property by seeing, well, what are comparable sales? What's been the sales comparables over the last 12 months? And pick the ones, obviously, that are 30 days out, 60 days out. But don't go by what's on the market, or don't go by the highest comp sales. I like to always go by the lowest comparable sales and find out the story behind why did that one sell, compared to the property that I'm looking at.
Fabian, you say that your work shows Fannie Mae and some of these other major government-sponsored entities or enterprises, they could be holding huge inventories in excess of 1 million houses off the market.
Yeah, I mean, we put the number anywhere between 7 and 10 million, which is better than it was several years back, which we had estimated over 20 million homes on the market. So yeah, 7 to 10 million. And here's the thing: with a lot of these properties by Fannie or government-sponsored other entities out there that hold real estate, like the FDIC and others, we find that the majority of those properties are left over from 2007, 2008 from the crash. And by the time Fannie Mae gets around to those properties actually hitting the general public, hitting the market like this one you're talking about now, it could take 3 to 4 years. Now, in between that time period, it's very likely a private equity firm or a hedge fund or a Wall Street firm has come in and bought that property. So those are the type of sales many times that people will see. I mean, not to mention there weren't people that made good decisions and bought in 2009 and got great deals on stuff, and now they're able to sell for 2-3 times the amount. Those aren't all Wall Street. But by and large, that's why you're seeing properties that sold in 2008 or 2009 for so cheap, and then today we see prices 3, 4, 5 times that, is because it's properties that have never hit the market in the last 6 years. And that's one of the biggest factors that I think are driving that.
But let's talk about the implication. Let's extrapolate forward here. Is this huge seawall of inventory going to hit the market? Or how can I get in that action? Or is it only hedge funds and institutions that can get a piece of it?
Well, I mean, listen, with respect to the latter question, I work with people every single day. You may know, Chris, I basically hold live events and education on real estate investing, and I train people all the time that are find where to tap this type of inventory and where to go to try to find it, because it's out there. A lot of it's public information. So, I think it's really kind of having this mentality of being a detective. Now, to the first point of your question, is what happens if the inventory hits the market? Well, I don't think the inventory will hit the market all at once. If it did, it would absolutely collapse prices overnight. And this is where I go back to this collusion between media, government agencies and politicians, and the big banks, where you constantly hear, I mean, how many times have you not heard, inventory is tight, there's no inventory, and that's why prices are going up? Well, that is total propaganda, completely not true. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of off-market inventory, and so what the big banks and what Fannie and some of these other big Wall Street players do is they trickle out the inventory, they control the supply, and then they boost the propaganda to really fuel that demand. And that's why in many markets you see people being able to pay more or are paying more for these homes, because they buy into that propaganda. Now, here's the big point here, is that when they unleash the cheap credit in waves, like I believe that they soon will, I've made the call they'll do this after the midterm election that's coming up. They started to do it before. You could potentially see prices go absolutely buck wild. It's total manipulation. But we know the gold market's manipulated. We know the stock market's manipulated. It doesn't mean that some people listening may not invest in those different markets. Real estate's the same way, and I think there's opportunity out there for educated investors.
Tell folks what they can find out at the notehouse.us.
Yeah, the notehouse.us is my private equity firm, and they can go there and get some more information about my firm, or to find out more about myself, they can just go to fabiancalvo.me. Either one will point them in the right direction and answer a lot of their additional questions they may have.
Excellent. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
It's always great to be with you, Chris. Keep up the great work. Love listening to the interviews, and thanks for having me on.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Against the backdrop of this week's sudden upswing in precious metals prices, I had a discussion with a business colleague about what it is precisely that enables people to deny and disown the creeping inflation in everyday life. I mean, we're led to believe that the latest annual inflation rate for the United States is 2.1%. For the 12 months ended May of 2014, as published by the U.S. government on June 17th. But if you're on a conscious budget and memorize recent prices that you've paid and actually think about what you've spent before you spend it, then you know that inflation is a whole lot more than 2.1%. If you're one of the few who pay cash for everything, you notice inflation, real inflation, and are not fooled by the 2.1% numbers that are published. If you charge things or cover things with credit, you mask inflation with credit, which is exactly what the government has been doing. The problem gets worse, and the day of reckoning becomes much more severe. According to the St. Louis Fed this week, total U.S. debt at the end of the first quarter of 2014, as of March 31st, totaled $59.4 trillion, which is up nearly half a trillion dollars from the end of the fourth quarter in 2013, according to this recent data. Total debt, which is the combination of government, business, mortgage, and consumer debt, was only $2.2 trillion 40 years ago. The trend is clearly negative. The Fed reported last week that consumer credit in the United States rose by 22% over the last 3 years and reached a record high of $3.18 trillion in April. On top of that, credit card use, or revolving credit, rose by $8.8 billion. And non-revolving credit like car loans and student loans increased $18 billion in April. Non-revolving credit jumped 8.2% over the last year, and revolving credit rose 2.2% over the same period. I believe that people who use credit are more prone to believe the government's phony inflation numbers because they are subsidizing the hidden, unacknowledged inflation that actually exists in the marketplace by charging it on their credit cards or absorbing it with student loans or home equity lines of credit. Human nature is to deny and disown inconvenient or uncomfortable truths. Debt is one of those enabling mechanisms that allows individuals, businesses, governments, and politicians who run them to ignore the future and act only in the moment. That may be expedient, popular, and temporarily gratifying. September and October of 2008 was nothing but a financial dry run for what is coming next. How quickly everyone forgets. If you didn't get crushed in 2008, you were lucky. If you're in debt of any kind right now, and especially if you're older, as in above 40, you had better be on guard, because the world is once again going to suddenly change. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.